Businesses may only get 3 days' notice for reopening is the main front-page headline for the Irish Examiner, above the story that owners must wait until public health experts and the government decide whether the risk from the Delta variant is such that the July 5th date must be put back. Publicans and restaurateurs want a decision this week, but according to the paper, government sources say it will be the middle of next week at the earliest, with a likely NPHET meeting next Thursday and a government announcement on Friday. Elsewhere on that front page, and also carried on the front page of the Irish Times and the Irish Independent, news that a consumer spending boom is on the way. The Independent has the angle that the ESRI is forecasting a massive 7.5% increase in consumption this year, followed by an 8.5% increase next year, while the Irish Times reports that the ESRI says our economy will rebound dramatically this year by growing 11% on the back of stronger exports and a resurgence in consumer spending and investment linked to the easing of restrictions. The lead story for the Irish Independent this morning comes from Hugh O'Connell's comprehensive interview with the Taoiseach Micheál Martin. Under the headline, Push to Free Up Family Homes by Encouraging Elderly to Downsize, he writes that under plans being considered by the government, elderly people living in large homes would be incentivised to move to smaller ones through a mix of tax incentives and grants. A detailed interview with the Taoiseach is also carried on page 3 of the Irish Times. The Irish Daily Mail leads this morning with coverage of the High Court settlement received yesterday by the couple whose healthy pregnancy was terminated after their baby was wrongly diagnosed with a genetic abnormality. Nothing will take away our sadness and grief is the headline, alongside a photograph of Rebecca Price and Patrick Kiley taken outside the High Court yesterday. Their picture is also on the cover of the Irish Times and the Irish Examiner. 2 decades after Holy Cross protest, I'm still living with the trauma, is the headline above the interview given by 24-year-old Belfast woman Alice Lee Bunting to Rebecca Black. The syndicated interview is flagged on the front of the Irish News with an image of Alice Lee as a child in 2001, surrounded by riot police on her way to school with her mother, alongside an image of her now with her own 2 young sons. Alice Lee was one of the scores of schoolgirls forced to run the gauntlet of a loyalist blockade on their way to Holy Cross Primary School in Ardoyne in 2001. She says that at the time she had no idea why she was being attacked and that 20 years later she still suffers flashbacks and nightmares. Her son Dara will start primary school in September. I'm just glad it's not something he has to go through, she says. The interview is carried inside several papers this morning. And the front page photograph this morning for the Irish Independent is of 6-year-old Fia Short from Dublin, who joined her grandfather Neil Minahan at yesterday's flotilla protest in the capital, seeking action against sanctions imposed by the EU Common Fisheries Policy. Fia is holding a poster with a message of support for her granddad, which says, Is Iskara Jensko Emu Yajo.
Could the row over the ownership of governance at the new national maternity hospital see the plans for the St. Vincent's site being scrapped and a fresh start being made elsewhere? That question and worries about the impact of the spread of the Delta variant and what that might mean for reopening, as well as Sinn Féin's absence from the Dáil on the special criminal court vote, are some of the main political questions this morning. And our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham, has more. And Paul, let's start with the National Maternity Hospital. And that surprising revelation from Dr. Peter Boylan yesterday, that there would appear to be a plan B.
Yeah, Dr. Peter Boylan isn't any ordinary doctor. He's the former master of the National Maternity Hospital and someone who's remained a campaigner on that issue and who's concerned about the possible ethos of the NMH being changed by being co-located at St. Vincent's Hospital. And he told RTÉ's Drive Time that he had spoken to Simon Harris that it was possible that other issues were being discussed, and he said that he believed that the government was considering a plan B. In other words, instead of co-locating the National Maternity Hospital at St. Vincent's, due to this ongoing row, there was a possibility of it moving to Talla. Now, that statement on Drive Time did put Simon Harris in something of a difficult political spot, because he's the former Minister for Health, who is currently the Higher Education Minister, talking about someone else's brief, namely Stephen Donnelly. Now, a spokesperson for Minister Harris said that he did meet Dr. Boylan, and they did have a discussion about the development of the National Maternity Hospital, and that he reiterated his view and the government's view that the state should own the land where it's built. But we didn't get any further than that. And the spokesperson said, as it was a private discussion, Minister Harris had no further comment to make. So Dr. Boylan says what he believes are the import of the conversation. Minister Harris isn't backing it up just yet.
And whether there is a plan B or no, even if there were, it's not necessarily going to be simpler than plan A and all the rows about the Vincent site, and would certainly take longer.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key concerns. I mean, the Taoiseach Micheál Martin told the Dáil that all options remain on the table in relation to St. Vincent's Hospital and this co-location. And the other two options are, one is that you possibly move us to another place, like Tallaght Hospital, or a second option is to try and engage in a compulsory purchase order to effectively take over the St. Vincent's Hospital site, either in part or in totality, as was suggested by the Labour Party leader, Alan Kelly. But we do know that if it's CPO, that's a legal process which is open to challenge and could be lengthy. And Micheál Martin himself said there was a possibility, at least, that you wouldn't have a hospital at the end of it. Whereas Tallaght means going back to the beginning, right back to the beginning of all of this. This process is already 7 or 8 years old. You'd be going back, possibly meaning that you wouldn't have a hospital for another decade. So those are the difficult choices that have to be made.
The other big story, the spread of the Delta variant, accounting for 20% of cases here, 90% in the UK, and the possible impact of all of that on reopening. The Taoiseach was talking to his parliamentary party about this.
Yeah, and he said that there was increased concern over the Delta variant, and he acknowledged that sort of while case numbers were stable and what he said, hospital numbers were flat, that the variant remains a big concern because it can have an influence. And he articulated that by saying the rise in case numbers in the United Kingdom were worrying. But how that's going to feed into government decision-making is unclear. Leveraker said nothing had been decided yet around further reopenings in July. That's a decision which is going to be taken next week. That will be on foot of medical advice supplied by Neffat and the Chief Medical Officer. So it's hanging there, somewhat suspended. We don't know what that's going to mean, you know, for the big plan to have indoor dining, or what it might mean for the question of the resumption of travel. Those are the two key decisions that the government is going to have to make. But it would appear, Anya, that won't happen until next week, as had been the original plan.
And the other story we're likely to hear more of today, Paul, is the Sinn Féin, well, non-appearance in the Dáil. They're on the special criminal court vote. They're getting criticism from Fine Gael on one side and from People Before Profit on the other.
Yeah, I mean, the question of what Sinn Féin was going to do on this issue had been clear that they were going to abstain. They had abstained last year, and so it was that the expectation was that they're going to abstain this year. The difference was is that when it came to the vote last night in the Dáil, the Sinn Féin members up sticks and left the chamber, so they didn't actually physically abstain. So Fine Gael was pointing this out, and we always have to remember the context of a by-election coming up in Dublin Bay South, saying that the Fine Gael charge was that Sinn Féin isn't doing what it said it was going to do, that this is an issue that they can't be trusted on. So you could see that from Fine Gael's point of view, they were making political hay. Sinn Féin sources saying last night they never said they were going to vote on it. They said they were going to abstain. That's what the party did. There isn't an actual issue here. And People Before Profit saying this was a curious decision that they'd taken. So it's certainly something which has a degree of momentum and will definitely carry into today.
Political correspondent Paul Cunningham, thank you. And
the Irish economy will grow by 11% this year. That's according to the latest report by the Economic and Social Research Institute. They provide research used to inform public policy debate and decision making. It's more than double what the government are forecasting, and it's because they say of more demand for Irish exports and more spending by people here, but lots of people will still be out of work and fewer houses will be built. Kieran McQuinn is research professor at the Economic and Social Research Institute. Kieran, tell us more about how much the economy will grow this year and why.
Good morning, Gavin. I suppose it has to be placed in the context, obviously, of the pandemic, which has had a very profound effect on the economy over the past 18 months. What we have observed during that period, however, is that the demand for Irish exports has not alone held up, but seems to have increased in certain areas. And so certain elements of our export sector have performed very, very strongly even last year in 2020, which caused us to actually have a positive growth rate and buck to the international trend in that respect. Those exports have continued to perform well in the data for the first quarter of this year. And so when we combine that with our expectation that domestic sources of demand in particular consumption and investment, are likely to pick up quite significantly now that the economy is being opened up. It leads us to this, you know, very substantial figure. So it's basically the combination of ongoing strong demand, particularly for pharma, ICT, from an export perspective, and then the very strong pickup that we're expecting in consumption and investment.
You say it's not an even growth. In other words, the extent of ups and downs are very different depending on the type of work that you're in. Tell us more.
Exactly. I mean, I suppose one of the characteristics of the pandemic has been the fact that it's had a very disproportionate impact on the labour market. So certain sectors of the economy, such as the export sector, the public sector generally, have remained completely almost unaffected by the pandemic and the ill effects of COVID-19. However, obviously, there have been certain sectors of the economy that have been devastated, the tourism sector, retail, hospitality sector generally. And so clearly, as you move forward, it's likely that some of those sectors are going to continue to struggle. Some may even have what we call structural change in the sense that they may not return to where they were before the pandemic. But then other elements of the economy are set to grow quite strongly. So it is relatively unequal in that sense. And that reflects, I suppose, the disparate effect of COVID-19 on the Irish economy.
What about the effect of Brexit and cross-border trade on this island?
Yeah, we've obviously only had one quarter of information, if you like, based on the agreement which came into place at the end of last year. What that shows at this point in time is quite a significant drop in imports from Great Britain. So if we look at the data in that respect, it's significant that we've had a sizable drop-off. Exports, on the other hand, seem to have been relatively unaffected. So there's been no real change in exports, but certainly a big fall off in imports. Now, that could be due to what we call the asymmetry in the tariffs that have been applied, or sorry, not the tariffs, but the customs procedures that have been applied in the two jurisdictions. It could also be due to the fact that there may have been a significant amount of stockpiling taking place towards the end of last year. Which means that the demand for imports would have dropped off sizably in the first quarter. But it's something which obviously we'll be monitoring going forward.
Even with the costs of the pandemic and expected falls in corporation tax because of recent international agreements, are you still saying the government can and should borrow to build?
Yeah, I think clearly in terms of the public finances, there's a short-term challenge of getting the, restoring some order to the public finances. We can't simply go on borrowing 4 or 5% of GDP on an ongoing basis. And as the economy improves, as we expect it to, I think those public finances will come back into order. From a borrowing perspective, though, over the longer term, I think, you know, the kind of calculations and assessments we've done in the report would suggest that there is the scope there to borrow on a modest scale, somewhere in the region of between 1-1.5% of GDP on an ongoing basis. And we feel, given the expected growth rate of the economy, given the expected costs of sovereign debt going forward, that is a feasible option for the government, which would yield around 5 to 7 billion in additional funds each year.
Kieran McQuinn, research professor at the ESRI, thank you.
Now, she is and has been for decades one of the most famous pop stars in the world. But Britney Spears has been speaking before a judge in Los Angeles, California, arguing passionately against the control she says her father has over her life under a court-ordered conservatorship. Free Britney protesters gathered outside the courtroom, while inside, by video link, Ms. Spears argued against the controls over her life for the past 13 years and the pressure that she's endured.
When do we want?
Free Britney!
When do we want it?
Now!
I will be honest with you, I haven't been back to court in a long time because I don't think I was heard on any level when I came to court the last time. I brought 4 sheets of paper in my hands and wrote in length what I had been through the last 4 months before I came there. The people who did that to me should not be able to walk away so easily. I'll recap. I was on tour in 2018, I was forced to do. My management said, if I don't do this tour, I will have to find an attorney.
Ms. Spears, I hate to interrupt you, but my court reporter is taking down what you're saying.
Okay.
And so you have to speak a little more slowly.
Oh, of course, yes. Okay,
and
I apologize, great.
Secret of everything you're saying.
Okay. Recap. I was on tour in 2018. I was forced to do. My management said, if I don't do this tour, I will have to find an attorney. And by contract, my own management could sue me if I didn't follow through with the tour. He handed me a sheet of paper as I got off the stage in Vegas and said I had to sign it. It was very threatening and scary. And with the conservatorship, I couldn't even get my own attorney. So out of fear, I went ahead and I did the tour. When I came off that tour, a new show in Las Vegas was supposed to take place. I started rehearsing early, but it was hard because I'd been doing Vegas for 4 years and I needed a break in between. But no, I was told this is the timeline and this is how it's going to go.
And that's just a short extract from some of the audio that emerged online of Britney Spears' testimony to Judge Brenda Penny at that Los Angeles courtroom hearing into the conservatorship, the court-ordered conservatorship that gives her father considerable control over her life. Suzanne Keane is the editor of RTE Entertainment Online. It was stunning after all this time to hear Britney Spears in her own words, wasn't it, Suzanne?
Absolutely. And I think once her fans, her Free Britney fans, heard what she was saying, you know, they had years have said Britney is in trouble, she needs help. But Britney herself in her testimony yesterday said, the world, I was happy, but I was saying, and everything that the Free Britney movement has been saying for years. She went on to tell the court, you know, that she'd been hated against her will, she'd been hospitalized, she'd been stopped from seeing her kids, she wasn't even allowed, you know, get kitchen cabinets.
And they really were dramatic claims, Suzanne, in terms of, you know, being forced to use contraception when she wants to have another baby, made take medications she doesn't want, made work on a punishing schedule that she called abusive.
Absolutely. And as I was saying, she said she told the world she was happy, but she's not. She confirmed last night she's lonely. She doesn't want to live this life. She wants her life back, that she's worked so hard throughout her life. And she feels she hasn't done anything wrong to deserve what is happening to her now. So it was absolutely bombshell stuff that came out of the courthouse yesterday.
What was her demeanour in the video link, from what, judging from the audio?
I think she sounded very put together. It sounded like a prepared statement that she had put together, but I think it was a surprise to hear how coherent she was and how well she spoke and how passionate she was. And it was, you could also hear the sadness in her voice that she's living this life that she absolutely doesn't want to live, that she feels trapped and that she really, really does feel alone and that there's nobody standing up for her.
So that's Britney Spears' side of the story. Who else will give evidence to the court?
Well, Jamie Spears is her father, and he has been overseeing her life, or her financial affairs and her personal life, for the past 13 years. So as part of her testimony last night, Britney actually said, you know, she feels the people who've been in charge of this conservatorship should be in jail. But it really, what happens now, it'll be, according to law in the US, it'll be a team of medical advisors who decide whether she should be allowed free from this conservatorship. Britney is asking that she's not evaluated again medically because she feels she's given so much. She's done so much therapy. She's going three times a week to therapy. She's been evaluated. She's been on retreat. She's been in rehab. And she does not want to be re-evaluated again. So it's the judge now who has to decide. She has petitioned the court, Britney, to be freed from it, and it is the judge now who decides what happens going forward.
And do we know when that decision will be, or likely to be?
There is another court date scheduled for July 14th, but the talk is we'll have to wait and see at this stage. We don't know exactly whether it will be decided on that date or it will be further down the line.
All right, Suzanne Keane, editor of RTE Entertainment Online, thank you very much indeed for that.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
Morning Ireland, 25 to 8. Sports news, obviously, and here's Des. Quite a night last night, wasn't it?
Great drama at the Euros. With 10 minutes of their game remaining, Germany were heading out of the championships. Huge surprise. But then a Leon Goretzka goal salvaged a 2-2 draw for Germany. Remember, they were at home to Hungary. It was in Munich. And that draw was enough to see Germany move from bottom of the group to finish second, and it earns them a clash with England in the last 16. The other game in the group, also dramatic. Two penalties from Cristiano Ronaldo helped Portugal squeeze into the last 16 with a 2-2 draw against France. Karim Benzema got both goals for the French. So world champions France win the group. Portugal, the European champions, finished third, level in points with Germany and Hungary, who were second in the group until the German equaliser go out. Ronaldo's two goals, by the way, takes his tally of international goals to 109, equaling the all-time record in men's football held by Iran's Ali Daei. Spain claimed the biggest win of the tournament in the afternoon. They had a 5-0 victory over Slovakia to finish second in Group B. Slovakia were eliminated, as were Poland, who lost 3-2 to Sweden, who topped the group. So, while some of you would be thrilled here, there are no games tonight or tomorrow. We then start the mouth-watering round of 16 games on Saturday. It's Wales against Denmark and Italy versus Austria. On Sunday, Netherlands versus Czech Republic and Belgium versus Portugal. Monday sees Croatia play Spain and France take on Switzerland. And on Tuesday, it's England versus Germany and Sweden versus Ukraine. There was drama too at the Copa America. Brazil went behind for the first time in 8 games, but they responded with a controversial equaliser from Roberto Firmino 11 minutes from time, and then Brazil scored a dramatic winner 10 minutes into stoppage time, Casemiro heading home from a corner, a 2-1 victory for Brazil. Nothing changes. Now, all of last night's sporting excitement wasn't confined to the football. Dublin are the 2020 Under-20 Leinster Hurling Champions. That's last year's final, delayed because of COVID. They beat Galway by 2 points in a very exciting rearranged final in Tullamore. It finished Dublin 120, Galway 118. Midfielder Mark Sweeney getting a great goal for Dublin. And Paul O'Brien's Dublin side now play Cork in the All-Ireland final. Meanwhile, Dublin footballer Kieran Kilkenny confirmed yesterday that team captain Stephen Cluxton is back in training with their squad ahead of the championship campaign. In golf, the European Ryder Cup captain Paul de Carrington has appointed 2 former US Open champions as part of his 5 vice-captains for September's Ryder Cup. Graham McDowell and Martin Keimer added to the team. He's previously appointed Luke Donald and Robert Carlson for his backroom staff. McDowell is delighted with his new role.
You know, I learned a huge amount in 2018 about, you know, what it takes to be behind the scenes. You know, like Padraig mentioned, you know, the captain's under a huge amount of pressure, and the vice captains, they really have to try and pick up the pieces for them a little bit. You know, how to communicate with the players, you know, what everybody needs, what the captain needs to kind of help him do his job. There's so much to it. It goes without saying that, you know, we'd love to be playing, but if we can't, this is the next best thing. You know, helping Team Europe achieve its goals. Watching these great young players kind of come up and achieve their dreams. And I'm really, really excited to kind of get going and hopefully win the Ryder Cup at Whistling Straits.
And finally for now, still on golf, Leona Maguire will be hoping to keep her good form going when she and Stephanie Meadow tee off in the Women's PGA Championship in Atlanta today. They're playing for a prize fund of €3.75 million.
Less people in hospital, less people testing positive for the virus for now, less restrictions on our lives, but more concern about the type of COVID-19 in circulation and what it will mean for all of the above. Health authorities on both sides of the border are finding more and more evidence of a Delta variant of the virus, which is more contagious and more resistant to just one dose of the vaccine. It's already dominant in Britain and expected to be across Europe over the summer. Northern Ireland's Public Health Agency says that around half of COVID-19 positive cases sampled there are now indicative of the Delta variant. This side of the border, over 200 cases have been reported in the last month, and over 1 in 5 cases are likely to be the more contagious variant. Let's speak to doctors in the Northwest now, and we can speak first to Dr. Tom Black. He's a GP in Derry City, and he's chair of the Northern Ireland branch of the British Medical Association. Dr. Black, good morning to you.
Good morning, Gavin.
The prevalence there in Derry and Strabane remains higher than anywhere else in the North. Tell me about what you're seeing at the moment.
Yes, the rate in Derry and Strabane area is 3 times higher than the rest of Northern Ireland. We're seeing a lot of sick children, sick younger people. We're not seeing sick older people. We're obviously seeing more of this Delta variant. As you say, about half of the cases in Northern Ireland are Delta, and that we expect that to increase to about 75% over the next couple of weeks. But certainly in my surgery this week, we're seeing lots of sick children, some with COVID, but many not with COVID, although, of course, with young children, sometimes they test negative. But nobody in hospital, or very few in hospital, 13 cases throughout all the hospitals in Northern Ireland, and no patients in intensive care. So the vaccine's holding up well, very few positive Delta cases in the over 60 age group. So the vaccine's holding up well, and we don't see a lot of patients going into hospital, which is good.
Dr. Black, how do you know what you're seeing is Delta?
You don't, obviously, as a GP, you're seeing patients very often before they've had their test on, their PCR test. But we're certainly seeing a lot of children with the symptoms that are consistent with Delta upper respiratory, sore throats, runny nose, temperature, which are more the features of the Delta rather than the Alpha variant that we've had up till now.
Stay with us. We're also joined by GP Dr. Dennis McCauley in Donegal. He's chairman of the GP subcommittee of the IMO and he's based in Stranorra in County Donegal. Dr. McCauley, tell us what you're seeing at the moment.
Gavin, what we're seeing is we're seeing an upswing in upper respiratory infections, but so far, very few of them have come back COVID positive. We're a little bit hamstrung on the side of the border, unlike Tom, where the malware attack has decreased the amount of information we're getting nationally. And as well, with the malware attack, people are tending to go to the test centres directly. So that means that we're not getting information back as GPs, which has issues for us for planning, also to ensure that there's actual compliance with the public health guidelines by the patients. And ultimately, if there is a surge, it could affect testing capacity. But we are the same economic and social unit. If Tom is having a Delta virus upswing in Derry, we are having one here. It's just we haven't actually recognised it yet. So what happens in Derry is the exact same as happens in North Donegal. So anecdotally, we're seeing some positives going up. And I suppose the big thing is, Delta virus, does Delta virus mean that you get more cases? Yes, it does. Even looking at Tom's figures in Northern Ireland, they're going up. Their 7-day average is going up, and Donegal was third in the league, up behind Carlow. We're actually picking up. So the issue with Delta variant is that it as well as more infectious, unfortunately, it translates into more cases.
Dr. Black, can any adult who wants a vaccine in Derry get one now?
Oh, yes, we've had pop-up clinics. That's the latest term for us, Gavin. Pop-up clinics for vaccinations. So we've established one in Craigan in Inner City Derry here, and we're concentrating on the 40 to 60-year-olds. So obviously over 60 with very few cases with positive tests. The 40 to 60 group, most people vaccinated, but there's still some gaps in that group. So we're concentrating on the 40 to 60s with the pop-up clinic. And then the under 40s, where the predominance of the cases are, mostly those folk don't get very ill, don't need hospital. So it's all about protecting the most vulnerable. And we're obviously doing enhanced testing or track and trace. And that's going on in Omagh and Ballymoney at the moment. And we're trying to pick up cases earlier.
And Dr. McCauley in Stranorra, do you think that restrictions on bars, restaurants, gathering in houses should be lifted on Monday week? Or where you are, does it make any difference given the rules in the north?
That's two questions. I suppose the first question is that it depends once again on the numbers. The modelling, we are really hamstrung by the numbers. If the modelling shows that there is a tendency for it to increase the numbers nationally, I think that has to be. We have to be brave and strong about that. As I say, here I think that we are the same. That we're talking about North Donegal only. We're the same social unit, so we will probably go. What happens in Derry and Strabane will happen in North Donegal, but naturally the added issue socialising indoors is a factor which we can't control. So I think we have to be brave. If we need to control it, we should do so.
Dr. Dennis McCauley in County Donegal and Dr. Tom Black in Derry City, thank you both very much for speaking to us.
The Euros going on and the Olympics coming up, there's plenty for sports fans to enjoy, even if it's only on the telly. And while our athletes on Team Ireland are getting ready for this postponed Olympics in Tokyo, a new plan's going to be launched today to prepare for Irish medals at European, World and Olympic level over the next decade. And Sports Minister Jack Chambers is here with more. But before we talk about all of that, Minister, let's talk first about the reopening plan. We were hearing earlier from Paul Cunningham, the Taoiseach, talking about his fears over the Delta variant and uncertainty around reopening. You'll be getting NPHET advice next Wednesday, I think, is it? It's been brought forward. The dark cloud of Delta, is it even darker?
Well, look, Delta is very concerning, but we still have a plan for the reopening of July 5th and that's, we've given the signal to people around that. But
There are
and
four.
The signal is, wait, we'll have to wait and see what NPHET says next week.
Well, but if you look at the four metrics that we're looking at, we've seen great stability in our case numbers. Our hospitalizations in ICU are still reducing, yeah, which is positive. We're seeing serious scaling up of our vaccination rollout, huge deliveries in the last 2 weeks. And also, I suppose the final red flag is this Delta variant, which we're seeing across Europe now, and it will become the dominant variant. So that has to be carefully monitored and reviewed, and we'll obviously take into account the public health advice next week, but also balance that against the broader reopening, and that the final decision around what's possible will be made next week. But I'm still hopeful.
So it is uncertain, you're hopeful, but you're not going to give anything away right now.
Well, I think if we're being honest with people, whenever we've set out the plan for the following 4 weeks, we've said that we'll review progress and then we'll give a firm indication of what's possible in the following 4 weeks when we get the latest advice, and that's being monitored carefully. But I think if you look at the broad metrics, there's still positive indications across caseload, hospital numbers, and the vaccine.
But here's the concern:
the Delta variant has to be monitored closely, and its impact on those who aren't vaccinated, and we have to take into account what's happened elsewhere as well.
Because the concern, as we heard yesterday, is that this is much more transmissible, even in an outdoor setting. There have been, you know, cases of, yes, unmasked, but very, you know, brief, fleeting contacts, and that was enough to pass on the infection. So what does that mean, for instance, because, you know, we're all looking at sports on the telly at the moment, but we want to be there in person. What does that mean for the return to sports fixtures for fans?
Well, just to give an update, we've had really successful pilots, they've gone really well, and the protocols have all been adhered to. I was at a couple of them myself, the Derry Offaly game, the Kilkenny Galway Camogie match, and Leinster Dragons, and it was great to hear the roar of fans back and people back in our stadia, and we're trying to build confidence in the safe return of spectators. And I know many in the public will want to see much greater numbers, and I share that ambition. So we are looking at scaling up our capacity for the return of spectators beyond our pilots, for which will conclude at the end of June and early July, and we'll be bringing forward proposals on significantly increasing capacity and giving enabling provisions to empower sporting organisations to get as many fans back as possible.
And say the Munster semi-final, Limerick and Cork, you're planning to have, what, 2,400 people there? Will you be using antigen testing?
So in the initial, when we outlined the pilot events, we've obviously produced a number. It's a controlled environment where there's social distancing. But just to say, there's a couple of things we are considering in the next phase. One of them is considering antigen testing, and obviously the government supports that and its potential role in getting significant increased numbers.
And have you asked NPHET to run a pilot for you?
Well, we are running a pilot as a department. So
with antigen testing?
That was announced by Minister Martin. There's a music festival in early July where there'll be antigen testing for over 3,000 people attending that event.
And that would apply to sports events,
and
the lessons learned there?
We're going to antigen testing will be part of our consideration for next week. And just to say as well, when people are looking at how we increase numbers in stadia, we want to do everything we can to increase capacity. Another way to do that is to actually have bubbles within our stadia, so that you take you drop social distancing amongst people who are in, say, bubbles. So for example, if people in an outdoor restaurant setting at the moment in a bubble
of six or even more,
and that means dropping social distancing for those bubbles and having a big net increase in capacity. So we're looking at ways to significantly increase capacity, get thousands back in our stadia, and we're developing proposals on that, and I'm as ambitious as anyone to get much bigger numbers at matches and move beyond pilot events so that we see them across our All-Ireland Championships, across our League of Ireland games and so on.
And all of those plans you're making to try and get people back into stadia, that'll all depend on the advice that comes from NPHET next week about Delta and reopening.
Well, I think we started off at very low numbers. So I think obviously Delta would be considered broadly by government. But just to say, stadia are controlled environments. They're outdoor settings. And I think we'll see increased numbers at our stadia in July. And I'm confident about that.
These high performance plans for the next 10 years, what are you aiming to achieve and how are you going to deliver it?
Yeah, so this is a really ambitious plan for the next three Olympics, Paris 24, LA and then the 2032. And this is about delivering medals and success on the international stage. We've had brilliant engagement by Liam Sheedy and Sport Ireland with our athletes, trying to look at international benchmarks on how we have an athletes focused future when it comes to high performance.
So we've looked at similar sized countries and what they're doing and how we could be better.
So New Zealand and Denmark, for example, and they've had serious medal success when they produced a similar high performance strategy. And there's kind of three key areas that we're focusing on. How do we enhance the personal supports and services for athletes, so their transition from junior to senior, their education, their direct financial support. We're also
looking, it all about the money, or is it about other things as well?
No, also about expert coaching. So how do we produce brilliant coaches in Ireland? How do we make sure we retain and keep them? How do we go to the next level and international, have an international benchmark on our coaching? But also developing our sports campus and making it the true home of sport and putting serious capital investment in that. And I think, you know, we've got the international metrics here on bringing high performance to the next stage and underpinning that with investment. And it is about the individual athlete supporting their talent from a young age all the way through to their retirement, so they can see the full potential, see their full potential, and we'll see more medals for Ireland on the international stage.
I don't know, were you watching Hungary Germany last night? It certainly was some humdinger of a match. They're out now. But in terms of the UEFA decision on no rainbow when they're playing, an opportunity missed?
I think it was an opportunity missed. And I think UEFA should have celebrated the request from Munich to have the stadium lit up with pride. And I think it's really regrettable. I think even labelling it political was a missed point. And I think, you know, we need to be inclusive and celebrate pride this month. And also, if you take our own stadium, the Aviva, it's been lit up with pride colours since 2019. I think UEFA have missed an opportunity, and I think they certainly were, it was out of touch with what many people across Europe would like to have seen.
Sports Minister Jack Chambers, thank you very much for coming into us on Morning Ireland.
Workplace well-being has been on the agenda for most organisations in recent years, but the pandemic has accelerated that focus. IBEX surveyed HR professionals and found a notable increase in commitment for mental and physical well-being initiatives. Sharon Higgins is Director of Membership and Sector with IBEX. Sharon, the findings show that employers are placing a greater emphasis on workplace well-being. Can you talk us through some of those findings?
Yes, certainly. We've seen a significant increase in the level of support and activity for these within companies. To call out maybe some of the facts, we've seen supported leadership level now at 81% this year, and that's up 20% on last year, so a very significant increase. And equally, we've seen that these initiatives are now being called out explicitly, and well-being is being called out explicitly in companies' overall strategies. And that's nearly half of the companies, 44%, now have that in place. I think that's a really good indication that this is something that's here for the long term and not just for the short term. And again, that's up significantly on last year. And maybe again, you know, showing that trend, there's now specific budget for well-being in 46% of companies. Again, that's almost double what it would have been last year. So quite a lot of the research is showing that the companies are putting much more emphasis on the activities of keep well. Of well-being.
It also found that line managers are key to promoting a culture of well-being. But are those line managers getting the training and support that they need to do that?
Yes, certainly. When we looked to see what companies were going to do over the coming years in particular, so, you know, post-COVID and into the next phase, we've seen that 76% of the companies indicated that they are going to increase the variety of well-being supports that are there to their employees, but also 74% are going to focus on the manager skills to support them in terms of managing employee mental health. So there is going to be a really significant focus on that going forward.
Most organisations offer an employee assistance programme. Are more people availing of those programmes, and what supports did employees need from EAPs this year in particular?
Yeah, really interesting to see that companies are providing supports in two ways, through their EAPs and then through their own internal programmes. Their EAPs, maybe to call out some of them, so supports for personal resilience across 54% of the respondents, mental health supports again during COVID, no surprise, 49%, but also pregnancy loss supports now being provided across 49% of companies, financial well-being, similar numbers at 42%, domestic abuse supports 43%, so quite a wide range of supports now being given to employees through the company employee assistance programs.
And what other practical supports are organisations offering employees?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting as we look at the range there. The bike to work scheme has been a staple, and we've seen that continue to rise. So now 62% of companies are providing bike to work scheme for their employees. And I suppose that would have increased, you would imagine, even in the last year as due to COVID, and we see all the additional bikes on the road. But also ergonomic assessment and supports now being provided by 64% of companies. And you can imagine, again, with employees being in different locations, that has been very important. Also now, nearly half of companies providing flu vaccinations. And again, a similar number providing support for return to work after maternity leave. And interestingly now, in 42% of companies, we found that centrally organised physical activities are being put in place. So again, that's a huge shift, I think, in where companies would have been in the past. So lots of change.
Some positive findings there. Sharon Higgins, Director of Membership and Sector with IBEC, thank you for joining us this morning.
Businesses may only get 3 days' notice for reopening is the main front page headline for the Irish Examiner, above the story that owners must wait until public health experts and the government decide whether the risk from the Delta variant is such that the July 5th date must be put back. Publicans and restaurateurs want a decision this week, but according to the paper, government sources say it will be the middle of next week at the earliest, with a likely NPHET meeting next Thursday and a government announcement on Friday. Elsewhere on that front page, and also carried on the front of the Irish Times and the Irish Independent, coverage of the latest predictions from the ESRI. The Independent runs with consumer spending boom is on the way, reporting that the ESRI is forecasting a massive 7.5% increase in consumption this year, followed by an 8.5% increase next year. While the Irish Times reports that the ESRI says our economy will rebound dramatically this year by growing 11% on the back of stronger exports and a resurgence in consumer spending and investment linked to the easing of restrictions. The lead story for the Irish Independent this morning comes from Hugh O'Connell's comprehensive interview with the Taoiseach Micheál Martin. Under the headline, Push to Free Up Family Homes by Encouraging Elderly to Downsize, he writes that under plans being considered by the government, elderly people living in large homes would be incentivised to move to smaller ones through a mix of tax incentives and grants. Give Up Your Old Homes is the headline for that story in the Herald, and a detailed interview with the Taoiseach is also carried on page 3 of the Irish Times. And in other property-related news, the Irish Daily Mail has the story of the ongoing and intense bidding war for a 3-bed semi-detached house in Rathmines, Dublin 6. Last night, we're told, the price stood at €1.25 million, €530,000 above the asking price of €685,000 sought by the owners when they put it on the market last week. There's plenty of coverage too this morning of the pop star Britney Spears' bid to end her father Jamie Spears' 13-year conservatorship, which gives him control of her life and finances. Page 3 of the Irish Daily Star is devoted to the story. The 39-year-old star addressed a court in Los Angeles yesterday via video link, and she said that she truly believed the conservatorship is abusive. "I don't feel like I can live a full life," she said. 2 decades after Holy Cross protest, I'm still living with the trauma, is the headline above the interview given by 24-year-old Belfast woman Alice Lee Bunting to Rebecca Black. The syndicated interview was flagged on the front of the Irish News with an image of Alice Lee as a child in 2001, surrounded by riot police on her way to school with her mother, alongside an image of her now with her own 2 young sons. Alice Lee is one of the scores of schoolgirls forced to run the gauntlet of a loyalist blockade on their way to Holy Cross Primary School in Ardoyne in 2001. She says that at the time, she had no idea why she was being attacked, and that 20 years later, she still suffers flashbacks and nightmares. Her son Dara will start primary school in September. "I'm just glad it's not something he has to go through," she says. The interview is carried inside several papers this morning. And the continuing controversy over the new National Maternity Hospital is covered widely this morning. Tala, a viable option for maternity hospital, is on page 1 of the Examiner, which has the story that government sources confirmed that alternative locations, including Tala, have been examined, but that the preference remains a move to St Vincent's. And on page 5 of the Irish Times, above a question and answer style explainer on the situation, the headline poses a simple question. Why has the National Maternity Hospital project become such a mess?
Uncertainty over whether further lifting of restrictions to try and slow the spread of COVID-19 as more people are vaccinated will go ahead on Monday week. That's when pubs and restaurants were expecting to serve indoors and more gatherings were allowed in people's homes. But a final decision won't be made until late next week. The Taoiseach has told his party that there is increased concern over the Delta variant, a more contagious strain of the virus, which is more resistant to just one dose of a vaccine and which is growing in prevalence here and across Europe. Leo Varadkar acknowledged that case numbers are stable and hospital numbers were flat, but he said the variant remains a big concern and the rising case numbers in the UK, he said, were worrying. Dr. Mary Favier is a Cork-based GP, former president of the Irish College of General Practitioners and a member of NEPHET, that's the National Public Health Emergency Team. Dr. Favier, good morning again.
Good morning, Gavin.
Tell us about your own experience of COVID currently.
COVID numbers in Cork are relatively quiet, but as general practitioners, we're somewhat hampered because of the cyber attack. We're not getting the same data. We're not seeing the same referrals. What we are seeing is, unfortunately, people presenting to walk-in test centres in particular, you know, with symptoms, sometimes even in some areas like in Dublin, after work. So concerning uptick in the numbers. We see a rise in Athlone that people know about, but there's also a rise now in Waterford and a new pop-up centre opening there. So some concern about numbers, some concern as well about behaviours. We have done so well. It's solidarity that's got us here. Community has made us manage all this, but we just need to be careful now over the next few weeks.
Yes, as Dr. McCauley was echoing in Donegal earlier, because of the cyber attack, because you're not seeing cases and you're not monitoring them, are people less likely to isolate when they get symptoms as a result?
We would have always, as general practitioners, one of the most important parts of our role, besides sending electronic referrals for testing, was to give isolation advice. The detail about, first of all, who else in your family might need to be tested, close contacts, anybody with other symptoms, but also what isolation actually means, what staying in the house means, restricting your movements, what coming home from work, taking your children out of school actually means. We would have texted people routinely the HSE links to isolation. So we can't do that, so we're somewhat restricted, but it's a concern now. People understand that the Delta variant is more infectious, and the ECDC has said that Europe will have 90% Delta variant by the end of August. We already see that it's 20% here, 50% in Northern Ireland, so a concern in terms of increasing numbers.
But the number of cases is remaining steady. In fact, it's falling, and the number of people sick is not getting bigger either. If and when Delta becomes the dominant variant, what do you expect to change?
This is the challenge between... If we have a new wave, and unfortunately we're likely to, there is going to be some difference in this wave, because it's the difference between infection and disease. Infection in the first waves, in particularly in our older populations, largely equated with disease and very serious disease, illness, hospital, and on some occasions death, unfortunately. However, because it's our older populations are vaccinated, but not completely, and there are some gaps in it, in spite of an excellent vaccination program, the people who are getting infected, but less disease and less hospitals and ICU. However, that's very dependent on the numbers. So we might have 1,000 cases and manage, but will we manage on 6,000 or 10,000 cases? Inevitably, some of those young people are going to get quite sick, and unfortunately we may have deaths, but we'll have things like long COVID illness. So it is different. Vaccination is the answer. It's the pushback against infection, and we need more time to vaccinate. So it's a balance. It's different, but we need to be cautious.
If this is a race between variants and vaccines, how long more will it take the current vaccine program to get enough of a lead to reopen relatively safely?
But the vaccine program is really working very well. 3.5 million vaccines have been given so far, roughly half between the mass vaccine centres and half in general practice. And so 66% of the population have had a first dose. However, there are some gaps. So the 60 to 69s, only a third of those have had a first dose. And we know that this variant needs two doses of vaccines to be effective. And we would really remind people to get their second doses. So we delivered a huge number of vaccines last week. 340,000 vaccines were delivered across the country. So another 3 weeks would give us a further million doses, taking 3.5 million to 4.5 million, which would make a really substantial difference. At this time, it's all about vaccine in arms, and the additional 2-3 weeks would make a very substantial difference.
Okay, two or three more weeks, but restrictions are due to be lifted on Monday week. What's your personal view on the timing of those restrictions on more indoor mixing in pubs, restaurants and people's homes? Should they be extended?
I think it's the government will make those decisions. I think there'll be many variables that bring it, you know, to make a decision. I think it's a combination that it's a very hard decision. People are worn and tired, but it is the social solidarity that has got us here so far. It is the extraordinary community effort. And I think the feeling on the ground, and this would be the feeling of many general practitioners, is vaccination saves lives. If it's 2 to 3 more weeks so that we can prevent ever having our health service in the same circumstances it was in January, or ever having that number of deaths again, or ever going into another lockdown, I think the sentiment out there would be that we would delay very strategically, because you've got to remember that what we're asking, the reason these are the final steps of opening up is because they're the riskiest. It's indoors, it's closed spaces, it's lack of ventilation. And in the interim, we really ask people to keep with the basics, the things they've been doing so well, the masks, the social distancing, the washing hands, the staying outside, because in the end, that and vaccination are what will save the situation.
Dr. Favier, when will NPHET meet to discuss what to advise?
NPHET generally meets on a Thursday morning, but in the past we've been asked by the government to pull it forward to Wednesday on weeks where there's a cabinet decision to be made. That may yet happen. NPHET would be entirely open to that. Of course, it serves the government, and the figures will be in, and we will have a much better idea by then, because the numbers keep coming in every day. If we're in the same position next week as we are today, it will be an easier decision. If the numbers continue to deteriorate, that will be more problematic.
Dr. Mary Favier, thank you for speaking to us.
Ireland's vaccine supply lines now look so healthy that the Tánaiste suggested using surplus AstraZeneca vaccines for younger people in the months ahead. At the moment, the vaccine AstraZeneca, that is not recommended for people under 50. But many over 18s face waiting till September to be vaccinated, and with the Delta variant on the rise, that's a worry. On the other hand, many poorer countries are struggling to get vaccines at all, while the virus is raging throughout Africa, South America and India. Peter Power is the Executive Director of UNICEF, and this topic is one you're very concerned with. Do you understand, I suppose, first of all, the argument that many people here are concerned with at the moment, which is there's the Delta variant on the increase, even warnings about a Delta plus over in England, that young people, who so many of them, you know, they've been hit hardest by the pandemic and they're at the bottom of the queue. So a lot of people saying, look, if there's, you know, a chance of getting them the Astra in the next couple of weeks, give it to them.
Good morning, Anya. What we would say is that they're not at the end of the queue. The people in countries who have 1% and 2% vaccination cases, they're at the very, very end of the queue.
As low as 1% and 2%?
Yes, and
so
in many countries around the world, that is the vaccination rate. And what we would be saying in UNICEF is that it's not just the right thing to do and the ethical thing to do. And young Irish people understand this. It's not just an act of solidarity with the poorest people of the world, but it's now in Ireland's national self and strategic interest to share our excess vaccines with the poorest countries in the world. Young Irish people will benefit by the opening up of the world. The world will remain shut unless we expand the programme of vaccination, because this is, after all, a global pandemic. You cannot end a global pandemic by vaccinating one country at a time. If this pandemic, say, was confined to Ireland and we said, well, we'll just vaccinate Leinster counties first and we'll get to everybody else later on, I think everybody knows that's self-defeating, and we have to look at a much wider view and a much global view. It's not, as I said, just the right and ethical thing to do. It's in our own self-interest to do this.
So you're saying, instead of distributing any surplus vaccines we may have over the summer months to speed up the vaccination of younger people, we should be sharing that. Now, tell us about COVAX, what it is, and how it's not exactly matching the big promises that were made about it.
Well, COVAX is the global vaccine sharing program put together by the World Health Organization, the Global Vaccine Alliance, supported by wealthy countries, including Ireland. Ireland has made a very welcome contribution of 5 million euro. And it's designed to ensure that all countries in the world receive an equitable distribution of vaccines. This unbalance between wealthy countries countries and poor countries is just simply unfair, but it's also going to come back to bite us in the long run. And UNICEF plays a big part in COVAX because we already procure and vaccinate 2 billion vaccines for the children of the world, measles and polio and so forth. And we're putting that global infrastructure in place to vaccinate the very poorest people and the people in the most remote areas of the world. Unless we do this, just vaccinating one country or a group of countries, which is what we're doing at the moment, will not solve the problem in the long term, and we're only storing up problems for ourselves. So we have to take, as Ireland has traditionally taken, a more open view, a more sympathetic view, a more global view, and it's the right thing to do.
Just to give an illustration of what you're saying about, you know, the need for vaccine in many parts of the world, which are way, way behind on rolling it out because lack of supply. Mags Reardon runs a medical clinic in Malawi, and she's been telling our reporter, Joan O'Sullivan, about the level of need there.
Malawi is very, very poorly resourced in all areas of healthcare. There are, you know, less than 10 ventilators available in the country. Just the logistics of getting people to a hospital or to a clinic if they become ill is always a huge challenge.
Does the government in Malawi have adequate supplies of vaccine at the moment?
No, absolutely not. Malawi has received 490,000 doses of vaccine. There were 19 million people in the country. As of today, 170,000 people have been fully immunised. Transport is very limited and it's very difficult for people to get there. So the vaccines really have to be taken to the people. And that in itself, again, presents a huge challenge because the fact that vaccines have to be kept at a certain temperature. Once opened, the vials have to be used. So there would be a higher loss in Malawi than there would be in Ireland. We are in dire need of vaccines. There's less than 300 doses now left in the country.
Mags Reardon there talking about the shortage of vaccines in Malawi. And, you know, we saw at the G7, you know, big promises about a billion vaccines going to COVAX, and the developed world looking as if it was being very generous. But a lot of experts saying, actually, the need is more like 11 billion. So that wasn't quite the big promise it seemed.
Absolutely. Anya, we have been advocating at the global level and before and during the G7. And yes, these commitments are welcome. The timeline of these commitments is longer than we would hope for. The need is absolutely now. And there is a huge amount of vaccines in the world at the moment. Ireland is in a great place. Yes, we all want everybody to be vaccinated, but the HSC have rolled out an incredible programme. It's highly efficient. We've got the high percentage of take-up of the vaccine. There's high confidence in Ireland. So we're in a good place now. To quote Mike Ryan, you know, perfection is the enemy of the good. We can't be 100% perfect, but we can be good around the world, and that means sharing a percentage of our vaccines. And UNICEF, our commissioned research suggests that if we and other wealthy countries share just 20% of our vaccines, we would very quickly make up the shortfall that has had to be diverted to India, because India is the largest producer of vaccines in the world. So that it's not a huge sacrifice to make to show enormous solidarity around the world.
So in a line, what should Ireland do with any spare AstraZeneca vaccines this summer?
We should share a proportion of them with the developing world because it's in our interest to do so, and it's the right thing to do.
Peter Power, Executive Director of UNICEF Ireland, thank you very much indeed for coming in to us.
The Garda Commissioner Drew Harris is to appear before the Policing Authority today to explain the failure of Gardaí to properly respond to 999 emergency calls in 2019 and 2020. An internal inquiry led by an Assistant Commissioner into the handling of these priority calls has found that in hundreds of cases, Gardaí cancelled calls before there was an appropriate policing response. For more, let's talk with our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds. What's this all about, Paul?
Well, Gavin, this review of 999 calls began when a concern was raised in relation to how a victim of domestic violence who made an emergency call was dealt with. Now, an internal inquiry was set up to examine how domestic violence calls made between 2019 and October of 2020 were handled by the Garda computer-aided dispatch system, that's the CAD system, and why some calls were cancelled without receiving a proper policing response. Now, the CAD system deals with emergency or a priority one calls. There are four control rooms in Dublin, Dublin, Cork, Waterford and Galway, and all the calls are recorded on the system and logged under a particular code. Now, the inquiry, which has been led by Assistant Commissioner Barry O'Brien, isolated the coded calls that related to domestic violence. It identified about 3,000 such calls. These were then looked at in detail. The calls were listened to, transcribed, examined. Around half of the calls were found to have been dealt with correctly and no further action was deemed necessary. However, concerns have been raised in relation to the other half, and these have now been sent back to the regional control rooms, to the local assistant commissioners, to individual Gardaí, and the people who took the calls and the people who made the calls. These will all be contacted to see if these have been dealt with correctly or what problems have arisen. Now, that process is still ongoing, but already issues of concern have been identified, and the Garda commissioner is due to outline those concerns to the policing authority today.
Almost 8:30. We'll get to news headlines shortly. What do you expect the Commissioner to tell the policing authority today?
Well, he's already told the authority at the last meeting that the review has found many 999 calls were cancelled and therefore people in need were not given a policing response between the times of the review. Now, my understanding is that some of the calls that were not properly handled are distressed calls from women and in at least one case a child seeking help on the 999 emergency line. And while the Gardaí have yet to examine in detail what happened, issues have been identified with these calls. Issues such as the tone and approach of the call taker, the way the vulnerable person was dealt with, the absence of any follow-up in these cases, and other evidence that in some domestic violence cases, people who called 999 didn't get the policing service they were entitled to. I mean, one of the problems with the Gardaí is that it's now Garda policy under Operation Freeshift to go back to victims and potential victims of violence days, weeks, and even months after they first contact the Gardaí to make sure that they're still safe, that their situation hasn't deteriorated, and that even in cases where people say, the issues have been resolved, but that policy of checking up and reverting back was not done in these cases. And while there may have been an immediate response to a 999 call, there wasn't the appropriate follow-up because the cases were marked cancelled, which means they were closed, in many cases, prematurely and inappropriately.
Paul, thank you. That's our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. For more on our 212 offers, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com.
And Des is back with the sports news.
Yeah, and we're going to reflect on the drama and excitement that last night's European Championships provided. It was the final round of group games, so we were going to know at the end of it who would be playing who in the knockout stages. And with 10 minutes of their game remaining, Germany were heading out of the competition, which was pretty inconceivable at the start. But then a late Leon Goretzka goal salvaged a 2-2 draw for Germany against Hungary in Munich, and the draw was enough to see them finish second in Group F and earned them a clash with England in the last 16. The other game between France and Portugal was a 2-2 draw. Two penalties from Cristiano Ronaldo helped the holders Portugal squeeze through. Karim Benzema got both goals for the French. France topped the group. Portugal finished third, although level on points with Germany. And Hungary, who were second in the group until that German equaliser, went out. Ronaldo's double, by the way, takes his tally of international goals to 109, equaling the all-time record in men's football held by Iran's Ali Daei. But of course, Ronaldo would have scored them in lot tougher matches than Iran would have played back in the day. Spain claimed the biggest win of the tournament with a 5-0 win over Slovakia to finish second in Group E. Slovakia were eliminated, as were Poland, who lost 3-2 to Sweden, who topped the group. So, while there are no games for 2 days, a little breather for some of you, the mouth-watering round of 16 begins on Saturday, and we now know the lineup after last night's matches. So, on Saturday, it's Wales against Denmark and Italy versus Austria. On Sunday, Netherlands versus Czech Republic and Belgium versus Portugal. On Monday, Croatia meets Spain and France take on Switzerland. And on Tuesday, England versus Germany and Sweden versus Ukraine. And there was drama too at the Copa America overnight. Brazil went behind for the first time in 8 games, but they responded with a controversial equaliser from Roberto Firmino. And then Brazil scored a dramatic winner 10 minutes into stoppage time, Casemiro heading home from a corner, and a 2-1 victory for Brazil over Colombia. Now, all of last night's sporting excitement was not confined to the football, because we saw Dublin become the under-20 Leinster hurling champions for 2020. They had to wait a long time because of COVID. But last night, the young Dubs beat Galway by 2 points in an exciting rearranged final in Tullamore. It finished Dublin 120, Galway 118. Midfielder Mark Sweeney got the Dublin goal. And Paul O'Brien's side now play Cork in the All-Ireland final. Meanwhile, Dublin footballer Ciarán Kilkenny confirmed yesterday that team captain Stephen Cluxton is back in training with their squad ahead of the new championship campaign. In racing, later this morning we'll know the final lineup for Saturday's big Dubai duty-free Irish Derby. The final decorations close at 10 o'clock. Great story to Saturday's big race because of the small group of elite jockeys who are lucky enough to ride in the big race, Gavin Ryan and Ben Cohen not only went to the same secondary school, but they were in the same class in Scullerwan in Killinall. Gavin rides Fernando Vici for Dunnick O'Brien. Ben is on Earlswood for Johnny Murta. They're from neighbouring parishes in Tipperary. Gavin from Moy Glass. Ben, who's just 19, is from the neighbouring townland of Killusty. They've been friends a long time. They ride against each other daily. This is the first time they'll compete against each other in a Group 1. Ben will be having a second ride in the Derby and Gavin his first. And last night at Naas, Dave Keane spoke to both about what should be a big day for the pair.
Lads, there's a new dimension to the Derby this year. You've been watching it on the television for a number of years, but Gavin and Ben, you've both gone to the same school. You've known each other for a long, long time. I might start with you, Gavin, first of all. How long did you spend in school with Ben, and how long would you go back with him?
About 5 years in school together. I suppose you kind of, in small little towns we live in, rural Tipperary, you kind of always know the lads in the neighbouring towns. So I suppose you could say we've known each other a lot longer than that. And then obviously we're playing GAA for two opposite clubs, and there's obviously we're the neighbouring clubs, so there's plenty of rivalry and all that. Yeah, we've known each other a long time.
Was he better at hurling than he was as a jockey?
His hurling now was very moderate, very, very moderate. He had a wild swing on him, so yeah, he was. That was never going to be the path he was going to take.
Would that be correct, Ben?
Yeah, football was a bit better than hurling, but the two of them weren't great, no.
It's quite unreal to think that the two of you went to school together, secondary school, and have known each other for so long, and now you're both going to clash in the biggest race of the year in the Irish Derby.
I suppose we're just used to it now. We're used to competing against each other. We're always doing it in football, pony racing, and now we're doing it on the track. It's brilliant, really, when you think about it.
And it's Saturday, just another race, and would you approach it that way?
Yeah, just another mile and a half race. I'm liking this rain that is coming, all right. It might help my lad a bit. He's an easy horse to ride, so just presume just keep it simple.
And you're just on the back of a big success at Ascot. Would that give you more confidence, and do you look forward to, and I'm sure you're relaxed anyway, but for big occasions like this, the fact that you've done it on the big stage?
Yeah, well, that's it. When you're riding winners, you're always riding with more confidence, and I suppose the gaps open when you want them to, when you're riding winners as well. Once you get in the role, it's easy going, but no, it's great to be going well and riding those big winners at them meetings.
And Gavin, Ben's mount obviously trained by Johnny, your mount trained by Dunnicott. They've both ridden Derby winners. They've both made a very easy transition from being very good jockeys to very good trainers. And your horse, what's he like on the lead up to the race?
Took a while for the penny to drop him this year, but we put blinkers on him for his last start and he won impressively. So we always thought he was a nice horse last year. Won his maiden well in Leopardstown, and we were kind of always had in the back of our heads that he was going to be a Derby horse, so that was good to get that under his belt the last day. And as I said, he'll have the blinkers on again the weekend. I think it just helps him focus that little bit better. But he's a horse that seems to stay real well. He's very, very laid back. I think he's a wicked straightforward horse ride, so we're very confident in his chances.
Yeah, should be great. We'll be looking ahead to the race again tomorrow, of course. Good luck to the two lads. Finally, in golf, Leona Maguire will be hoping to keep her good form going when she and Stephanie Meadow tee off in the Women's PGA Championship in Atlanta today. They're playing for a prize fund of €3.75 million.
US President Joe Biden has announced Massachusetts State Representative and lawyer Claire Cronin as his nominee for ambassador to Ireland. She campaigned and fundraised for Joe Biden in Massachusetts during last year's presidential election, and her appointment will now need to be confirmed by the US Senate. Our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan has been telling us more.
Claire Cronin is an Irish-American, and last night she issued a statement saying she was deeply honoured to be nominated to the role of ambassador, especially, she said, given Joe Biden's and her own Irish roots. If confirmed, she said, she looked forward to serving as ambassador and working with partners in Ireland on both the challenges and opportunities ahead. Now, she said it there herself, if confirmed, and that is because US presidents don't appoint ambassadors, they nominate them. Claire Cronin will now have to appear before a Senate confirmation hearing, and US senators will then vote on her nomination. Now, Claire Cronin is a state representative in the Massachusetts legislature, and she's the House Majority Leader there, the first woman to hold that position. She's a successful lawyer, and she was also a big fundraiser and a big campaigner for Joe Biden in Massachusetts during the the 2020 presidential election. She was an early supporter of his and one of his biggest champions in that state during the Democratic primaries. She helped Joe Biden to win Massachusetts in those primaries, and this was a really important win. He beat his big rival, Senator Elizabeth Warren, who was from Massachusetts, and this win really helped boost Joe Biden's campaign. It propelled him on to eventually claim that Democratic nomination for president. And at the Democratic National Convention last year, it was Claire Cronin who was given the honour of being the delegate who officially announced that Joe Biden had won the state of Massachusetts.
What's been the reaction to her nomination?
Well, Gavin, the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, said he was delighted that President Biden had nominated Claire Cronin as the next US ambassador to Ireland. He said the early nomination reflected the strength and depth of the relationship that exists between the US and Ireland, and that he looked forward to working with her. The chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Democratic Congressman Richard Neal, also welcomed the nomination, saying that Claire Cronin will play a significant role in helping to strengthen the bonds between the US and Ireland. And look, broadly, lots of welcomes last night, lots of kind words on social media from campaigners, from politicians, but many of them saying that now was also the time for Joe Biden to appoint a US special envoy to Northern Ireland. It's not yet clear at this stage if or when that will happen. Now, Joe Biden likes to announce appointments in batches, and last night was no different. Claire Cronin was named along with 16 other nominees to various different roles. Cindy McCain, the widow of Republican Senator John McCain, was nominated as an ambassador to the UN Agency for Food and Agriculture. And Irish-born Fiona Whelan-Prine was nominated to the US National Council on the Arts.
Separately, Brian, you have an update on the search for Irishman Kian McLaughlin, who went missing from a hiking trail in Wyoming earlier this month.
Yeah, Gavin, listeners will remember Kian McLaughlin. He was last seen in the Grand Teton National Park in Wyoming on the 8th of June. Now, following days of extensive searches using dozens of staff, volunteers, search and rescue dog teams and helicopters, the US Park Service said last week that it was scaling back the search for Kian, but would investigate any new leads or clues as they emerged. And that is what has happened. A resident of Jackson, Wyoming, who recently returned from an international trip, has come forward with new information, and they reported seeing Kian McLaughlin on the day he went missing. The witness said they saw him in the late afternoon or early evening on a trail making his way south towards Taggart Lake. Now, this witness had a conversation with Kian where he described where he worked. He said he is from Ireland and that he currently lives in Jackson. Now, as a result of this new information, park staff carried out additional searches around Bradley Lake and Taggart Lake. They also searched the Phelps Lake area, which was an area that Kian McLaughlin reportedly likes to visit. Unfortunately, however, Gavin, no evidence or clues of his whereabouts were identified during these new searches.
DU leaders meet in council today and tomorrow in Brussels. One of the top items on their agenda is the fear that the Delta variant could hit EU plans to reopen travel and tourism. Our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, joins us with more. And this was supposed to be the council meeting where all the leaders mapped out the exit plan. But how much is the Delta variant derailing the best laid plans of the EU, Tony?
Well, it certainly cast a shadow over the summit, Anya, and that was reinforced yesterday when the European Centre for Disease Control, the ECDC, announced that they estimated that by the end of August, the Delta variant would represent 90% of all COVID cases circulating in the EU. So that is a fairly sobering figure. But it also complicates how the summer season is being opened across the EU. You know, we've heard a lot in recent months about the digital COVID certificate, this passport, if you like, that would allow people who've been vaccinated or who have a negative COVID test or who've recovered from the virus can travel freely across Europe. And of course, a lot of countries like Spain and Italy and Greece and Portugal, who depend very heavily on the tourist industry, have been pushing for this opening to happen. But now, of course, there's a big question mark over how quickly that opening should happen and whether or not people from the UK in particular should be granted access to some countries. And there is going to be a fairly difficult conversation this afternoon between leaders on that subject. Spain, for example, allows UK tourists in without even a PCR negative test. Other countries like Portugal are very keen to get UK travellers in, but countries like Germany are saying, hang on a second, we have to try and limit the entry of the Delta variant into Europe because of the fact that it's so transmissible, so infectious, and could hit those parts of the population who've not yet been vaccinated.
And the other big item that's been making some headlines, it's certainly the lead in the Financial Times, Berlin and Paris propose reset for EU relations with Moscow. It's a big move by Angela Merkel, isn't it, shortly before she departs the European scene?
Yeah, this landed very suddenly yesterday. It was a joint proposal from France and Germany to have a much deeper engagement with Vladimir Putin, even to the point of having a leader summit with him, and those haven't happened since Russia annexed Crimea. But alongside that carrot, if you like, both countries have proposed that the EU would keep in reserve a kind of a toolbox of sanctions against Russia, including sectoral economic sanctions that could be targeted if Russia misbehaves, as they would see it. So on the one hand, they're saying, look, if Joe Biden can have a summit with Vladimir Putin, why can't the EU? And it would allow the EU to speak with one voice on Russia. And there are lots of areas like climate change, like energy, that the EU has to engage with Russia on. So why not do it that way and have this set of harsher sanctions in reserve if needed?
And will Brexit feature at all on the agenda, Tony?
It's not going to be a major item on the agenda, although I understand that the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, will brief leaders on the Northern Ireland Protocol and, I suppose, the sensitivities around the protocol in Northern Ireland and the marching season and so on. And this obviously comes against the backdrop of the UK's request to extend the grace period on chilled meats, which the European Commission signalled yesterday that they were willing to do. And, of course, that all has to be agreed by member states and agreed fairly quickly. So I suspect that will be part of the Taoiseach's message to EU leaders this afternoon.
OK, Tony, thank you very much indeed for that. That's our Europe editor, Tony Connolly.
The first British-Irish intergovernmental conference in more than 2 years at Dublin Castle today. The ongoing political instability at Stormont and continuing disagreements over the Northern Ireland Protocol will top the agenda. We're joined now by our Northern editor, Vincent Kearney. Why so long, Vincent?
A number of factors. I mean, the last one was back in May 2019. There, one had been scheduled in November 2019, but then the British general election got in the way. And since then, COVID restrictions have made it impossible to convene. Now, the Irish government in particular had wanted a meeting like this for some time, so it was agreed last month because I think Dublin was concerned that, as far as it was concerned, the British government was disengaging from Northern Ireland and certainly wasn't paying as much attention as it should have been. So I think that today they'll be put on as much pressure as possible to get them re-engaged.
So tell us about who's going to be there and what are relationships like between the two governments?
Relations are improving, let's say. I don't think they were good for, a period of months when, as I say, Dublin certainly felt that the Northern Ireland officer and the Secretary of State, Brandon Lewis, wasn't as engaged as his predecessor, Julian Smith, had been. But the pace has changed in recent weeks. There was a feeling last week that both governments had secured a breakthrough with that deal. The British government agreed to introduce Irish language legislation that secured Sinn Féin's agreement to go back into government with the DUP. While the British government was involved in negotiations, Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney was kept informed of progress at regular intervals and had some input. But of course, that is unraveled now because they thought they'd averted a crisis. What they couldn't foresee was an internal revolt against DUP leader Edwin Poots. This ousted him from office. It's going to usher in a new DUP leader. So they're going to have to try to square that circle as to how they get Jeffrey Donaldson back on board, how they get the DUP back into government with Sinn Féin. So relations are going to have to be good. But they were soured a little bit last month. Remember, Brandon Lewis went to Dublin and met Simon Coveney, and Hours later, the British government announced that they planned to ban prosecutions of former soldiers questioned or suspected of killings in the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And that hurt, I think, and surprised the Irish government, because from what we can gather, there was no advance notice given by Brandon Lewis to Simon Coveney they were going to do that. There was quite a backlash afterwards. The Irish government said they would oppose any such move by Boris Johnson. So I think there'll be a bit of repairing of bridges going on today as well, because certainly the Irish government felt that they were blindsided by that announcement.
As you said, it's 2 years since they met, and a lot has changed in the meantime. What difference has COVID made to British-Irish relations?
I think certainly today COVID is going to be high on the agenda. It's forcing them to work more closely together. There have been disagreements over common travel area through access, through travellers from Great Britain into Dublin, having to quarantine, having to fill in their passenger locator forms. There have been claims from the Stormont administration that those passenger locator forms have not been shared properly. So there have been issues there. The big issue now, of course, is this increased concern over the Delta variant and what that might do, because it's more widespread in Northern Ireland now. More than half the cases in Northern Ireland are down to Delta variant. And we've heard a ton of Leo Varadkar expressing concern about the increase in impact that's going to have on plans to open from the 5th of July. So I think today there'll be a lot of focus on how they try to mitigate that variant and work more closely together. But the problem has been over the past year or so, they've talked a lot about working together, but quite often in practical terms, it hasn't worked out.
Yes, they also have to talk about the protocol variant of Brexit.
Indeed they do, and no meeting of minds there. I mean, we've heard Brandon Lewis as recently as yesterday saying once again the protocol simply is not sustainable and that changes are needed. And interestingly, that followed comments by the outgoing DUP leader Edwin Puig, who told the BBC yesterday he'd been promised some movement on the protocol, that Brandon Lewis had told him major changes on the way. Now, when pressed on the detail, he wouldn't go into any of the detail, but now we hear, of course, from Tony Connolly that the EU may well extend the grace periods on chilled meat by another 3 months. So Geoffrey Donaldson perhaps might try to sell that as some kind of a victory as he goes into the leadership of the DUP and perhaps use it as a bargaining chip with the British government. But the DUP made it clear that what they see as a temporary fix, a sticking plaster fix, if you like, won't work. They want the permanent fix, whereas the Irish government has been very clear, as far as they're concerned, the protocol is there to stay. They don't mind mitigations and flexibilities, but they say it's there to stay. The DUP and the British government are increasingly saying the protocol has to change dramatically or go. So obviously at loggerheads on that issue as well.
Vincent Kearney in Dublin today, rather. Thank you. It's